Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Overall in 2025, we're expecting kind of lower than normal, but near normal growth in food at home or grocery prices across categories in 2025.
Talking food price projections, USDA economist Megan Schweitzer.
So overall for food at home prices, we are expecting them to grow by 1.3%, which is just 0.1% higher than what we saw in 2024 when grocery prices grew by 1.2%. And that's lower than the long-term average over the past 20 years, which has seen average annual growth of 2.6%. We're really expecting kind of this trend that we've seen since the beginning of 2023, where prices have moderated following those really high increases in 2022. We're expecting to see that continue into 2025.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In a Trump economy, the winner's circle is small, and it's dominated by the ultra wealthy.
Ranking member of the Senate Treasury Committee, Ron Wyden from Oregon, during a confirmation hearing for Scott Bessent.
Working people in the middle class are on the outside looking in, and Trump and his advisors are indifferent to the problems they face each day. I've had more than 1,100 open-to-all town hall meetings in my state. I'll have several more this weekend. The second word I hear from Oregonians in those meetings is almost always bill. Grocery bill, medical bill, electricity bill. Americans feel held down by the cost of living. They look at the growing fortunes at the top and they weigh that against their sense that America's middle class just doesn't have the opportunities to really get ahead. The American people voted for change, and more than anywhere else, they want change in the economy. I don't believe they're going to get it from Mr. Bessent or Donald Trump. The centerpiece of the Trump economic agenda is extending his 2017 tax law at a cost of more than $4 trillion. Ultra-wealthy individuals who rake in millions each year would get tax breaks of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Families who live paycheck to paycheck would be lucky if they could just get enough to cover the grocery bill for a week.
Again, Scott Bessent, considered for Treasury Secretary and addressed by Wyden.
One last question, and that is about the legislation that was written in this room that was the biggest transformation on clean energy in American history. That is our package that basically said the tax code as it relates to energy is a broken down mess. And we basically said we're going to have a technology neutral system. The more you reduce carbon, the bigger your tax savings. Now there is a big effort in the Trump administration to reverse it. I think that's going to be bad for the economy, but it is going to be damn good for China because we are in an arms race on clean energy with them. Are you going to be on the side of people who want to unravel this?
Senator Wyden, just so we can frame this for everyone in the room, China will build 100 new coal plants this year. There is not a clean energy race. There is an energy race. China will build 10 nuclear plants this year. That is not solar. I am in favor of more nuclear plants. And I would note that the IRA, as scored by the CBO, is wildly out of control in terms of spending on the upside.
Well, first of all, the clean energy package does protect nuclear because members on both sides of the aisle in this room wanted it to be that way. But if you're going to talk about fossils, the United States has achieved a greater level of energy security than we've had in generations. Oil and gas production is at record highs. And it's not just that, but it's about clean energy. And I'm very troubled by your position denying that we're in an arms race with China on clean energy, because we definitely aren't.
Nomination hearing for Scott Bessent to be the next Treasury Secretary of the U.S. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have to deliver.
It's Texas Representative Chip Roy taking to the floor of the House of Representatives, challenging Republicans to do their job.
My friends in the Freedom Caucus, other conservatives, we have put forward a plan that we believe would deliver and deliver quickly. We don't have time to waste. The president needs resources. Tom Homan needs resources. The Border Patrol met with the union this last week. They need resources. ICE needs resources to do their job. So let's do it. They want $86 billion. Let's find it. We can. The defense needs to be modernized, built up after getting undermined and focused on all sorts of ridiculous woke and DEI policies. We need a new, modern, robust military to beat China. We can do that. We've put forward $200 billion over 4 years under President Trump to modernize the military, an additional $50 billion a year. Let's do it. We can do it, and we can pay for it. We said we would raise the debt ceiling 2 years, about $4 trillion. We're not inclined to want to raise the debt ceiling, if you haven't noticed, but we'll do it. The president wants us to get that aside so Chuck Schumer can't play games with the bond market. So let's get rid of the debt, or let's increase the debt ceiling. Let's get $86 billion for border. Let's get $200 billion for defense. And then let's apply a handful of cuts to pay for those things. Let us, I don't know, how about repeal the student loan fiasco? It's $100 to $270 billion. How about let's just apply Medicaid work requirements so that if you're on Medicaid, for able-bodied Americans, not all, but the able-bodied Americans, that they must work. Pretty popular issue. Every Republican's voted for it. $120 billion. So we can pay for defense, pay for border, make our Medicaid system better, reverse the ridiculous student loan bailouts, which are giving money from one American to another. The plumber who never went to college is subsidizing the sociology major sitting in their parents' basement, tweeting about nonsense. How about we end that? You pay your student loans. You took the loans out. Plumber, you didn't. Go do your thing. Every American that I know that works hard agrees with that. We can do that. Conservatives, the Freedom Caucus, have put that forward. We want to support President Trump. We want to make sure that President Trump can deliver on the border, get the debt ceiling away from being used politically by Chuck Schumer. And so we put that plan forward. I think we should have already done it. But as usual, we sit in this body and we debate. And we continue to debate. And unfortunately, we're still debating. And unfortunately, in my opinion, we're going to continue to debate. Because there is a real debate going on about taxing and spending. And I'm blowing Republicans' minds when I say, I'm all for tax cuts, but you better cut the spending so that we can actually reduce deficits. So I've been pretty clear about that. A lot of my colleagues have been pretty clear about that. Some of my colleagues here seem to want nothing but tax cuts and no spending cuts. But I'll also hear a lot of my colleagues say, oh yeah, I'm for the spending cuts. I say, okay, well, how many? How much? Well, I mean, as many as we can get. Okay. Are we going to reduce deficits or not? I mean, that's the question I'm going to be asking everybody. Can you do math? And are we going to reduce deficits? That's the question every American sent us here to do. Do the hard work. Sit at the table. Why don't we put the microphones down, put the cameras away, use these tables, roll our sleeves up, get the paper out, and do the math. Yes, tax cuts can and do produce economic growth. More money in the hands of the people. Yes, it is morally correct to leave more money in the hands of the American people. I would gladly vote to get rid of the income tax. Zero it out. Leave the money in the hands of the people. But guess what? Whether it's President Trump's vision or views on tariffs, whether it's something else, there has to be some amount of revenue to pay for all of the promises and all of the programs that every politician loves to go home and run on.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've only briefly described some of the important bipartisan pieces in FOFA, but it involves much more to make forests more resilient, healthier, and safer from sea to shining sea.
FOFA is our Fix Our Forest Act. And Bruce Westerman from Arkansas.
All these tools available in this bill echo a similar theme. We must restore common sense to our approach to forest management. This comprehensive package is the result of years of hard work and bipartisan collaboration formulated through hearings, site visits, and member feedback. Fixing our forests should not be a partisan issue, and today it's not.
California Representative Tom McClintock.
My friend Mr. Huffman is concerned about climate change and carbon dioxide. Well, he should know that a UCLA study revealed that just the 2020 fires in California alone released twice as much carbon dioxide as had been prevented by 17 years of the restrictions and regulations that California has imposed, costing its consumers and taxpayers billions of dollars. Now, we were able to get a categorical exclusion from NEPA for forest thinning projects in the Tahoe Basin in 2016. In the 9 years since its enactment, it's reduced the approval process for forest thinning projects at Tahoe from 5 years to less than 4 months. It's reduced the environmental reports from more than 800 pages down to a few dozen. Timber harvested has increased from roughly 1 million board feet a year to 9 million board feet a year. The treated acreage has tripled, and the Tahoe forests are returning to fire resiliency. This is what saved the city of South Lake Tahoe from the Caldor fire 2 years ago. Now, the town of Grizzly Flats, which was not protected by this law, was wiped out by the same fire.
Jared Huffman from California.
It's always refreshing to hear my colleagues across the aisle who typically deny climate science forcefully suddenly get interested in things like CO2 emissions, and they have discovered correctly that forest fires actually cause CO2 to go into the atmosphere. So I guess that's progress. I hope now they will begin to listen to the overwhelming majority of climate scientists who are saying that this fossil fuel energy bonanza of theirs is actually the primary driver of catastrophic climate change. It's the reason we have record-breaking disaster one after another because of this fossil fuel bonanza. And I hope that we can build on the progress, this awakening that we've begun to hear on at least some climate science. Now, it was mentioned by the chairman, I believe erroneously, that forest treatments have gone down since the passage of the legislation that I mentioned two Congresses ago. In fact, we need to do a little bit of correcting there. Since the passage of these two laws, the Forest Service has been treating a record number of acres, including a record number of prescribed fires in California and across the country. We also know that from 2002 to 2023, the Forest Service consistently increased the acres that it treated. But let's pick up where the Trump administration left off. 2.65 million acres treated in 2020, and we know that the Biden administration was able to treat 4.3 million acres, a lot more than the Trump administration in 2023. The numbers admittedly leveled off over the last 2 years because of Republican budget cuts, but they've still topped 4 million acres a year. And so it's a very different trajectory than what has been suggested.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of history here where the lesser prairie chicken, its native habitat, for those that aren't familiar, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, Oklahoma Panhandle, Texas Panhandle, New Mexico.
Kansas representative and member of the House Ag Committee, Tracy Mann.
The Biden administration, after we strongly resisted, they went ahead and listed it as endangered and as threatened, which is a whole bunch of regulations for ag producers. So I introduced legislation in the House, Senator Roger Marshall, in the Senate, to delist the lesser prairie chicken. We have 14 co-sponsors so far. But this is needless, burdensome regulation that just makes it harder for our farmers, ranchers, ag producers to do what they do best. It will result in higher food prices, which is not what anybody wants. So let's return to common sense. Let's have producer-driven conservation efforts, and let's repeal these bad rules that President Biden put forward.
And under the previous administration, they scrapped a voluntary effort by the Fish and Wildlife Service to manage the lesser prairie chicken.
These programs need to be, these efforts need to be bottom-up, producer-driven. I've never met a farmer, rancher, ag producer that doesn't care about the land, doesn't care deeply about the environment, doesn't care deeply about their soil. When you really look at the population of the birds, they go up and down based really on rainfall. And years that we have drought, which we've had some severe droughts over the last 3 or 4 years, the population go down. Year that rainfall's up, the population goes up. But these heavy-handed, top-down burdensome regulations make no sense. I had a farmer in Morton County, which is about as far south and west in Kansas as you can get, told me that they, after his regulations went through, somebody spotted a lesser prairie chicken in his pasture. They had to immediately remove all the cattle from that pasture and each of the adjoining pastures as well to protect this bird. It just makes no sense at all.
And then there's the issue of salmonella.
Well, it's on my radar because the Biden administration used unsound, really no science to push further regulations of our poultry producers, which really hits our all sizes, but really it's our small, medium-sized poultry producers. The result will be it's just going to drive up the price of food. It's going to make them less profitable. In the long run, it's going to increase the price of food and lead to further food inflation. The facts are, and the real science says, that salmonella issues or contaminations in the last 4 years are down 60%. Now's not the time for more heavy-handed, burdensome regulations that were not vetted, were not thought out to be jammed through the Biden administration, which they did in just the last couple of months. So we're working to repeal that harmful regulation as well. Of course, everybody's for a safe food supply, but this regulation is going to drive up costs and really not do much of anything to improve the safety of our food supply.
What's the latest on the farm bill?
Well, and I think you bring up a good point. You know, farm bills are five-year bills for a reason. 5 years is long enough to provide some certainty, but short enough to adjust and adapt and change with the times. And certainly you look at where agriculture is at in 2018 versus today, the biggest difference on production agriculture side is where input costs are. And you can't dramatically increase our input costs and think that the farm safety net is where it ought to be. And so I've been to the floor of the House, I think 34, 35 times now, urging Congress to get serious, get motivated to get a five-year farm bill locked in place. These year-long extensions, sometimes 2 months, but year-long extensions do not provide the certainty that our ag producers and their lenders need as they work to feed, fuel, and clothe the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And I just want to say that the time to fix our forest is now.
Last week, the House debating the Fix Our Forest Act. Only one forester in Congress, Bruce Westerman from Arkansas.
Actually, now is not the real time to fix our forest. The time to have fixed our forest was yesterday. It was last year. It was 10 years ago. It was 30 years ago. The condition our forests are in now is the result of bad management decisions over a long period of time. It's kind of like the saying about planting a tree. The best time to have done it was when you're a child. The next best time is today. And if not today, we need to do it tomorrow. Regardless of where and when catastrophic wildfires occur, they offer a grim lesson. The cost of thoughtful prevention would have been far less than those inflicted by merciless flames. The old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is never more true than when it comes to managing our forest. We spend billions of dollars fighting fire every year. Our forest should be an income stream to our federal government, not a cost. People manage forests all over the country, and they actually produce great products that go into homes, that go into sustainable buildings, that actually become a carbon sink because wood is 50% by weight carbon. And when you build with wood, this table was atmospheric carbon that was stored in this wood at some point in history. And it's still in this wood. Instead of burning these forests up and spewing more carbon into the atmosphere, we should be looking at innovative ways to use our forests, to keep them healthy and resilient, because they do provide clean air, they provide clean water, they provide wildlife habitat. But they don't do that when they're burned to the ground. And these fires oftentimes are so hot that they burn the organic material out of the soil. So it's hard to get trees to grow back. We've seen this in the Angora fire. I visited it several years ago. It was 12 years after the fire, and it had been replanted 6 times, and the trees still wouldn't grow on it because the soil had been so damaged by these intense wildfires. The argument has been made that these fires are a result of climate change. If that is the case, the question still remains, what are we going to do about it? We have unhealthy forests. They're way overstocked, way more trees per acre than we've ever seen. Small trees that are competing with other trees for light, for water and nutrients, and they get weakened and they die and insects and disease come in. And this just isn't California. It's all across our country. We know what to do. The question is, will we do it? The Fix Our Forest Act will give us the opportunity to do what we know needs to be done. I've talked to many of our land managers, federal land managers across the country. It's disheartening to them to have gone to forestry school or whatever educational experience they had, and they wanted to commit their life to working in an area to make a difference, and they see these resources they're charged with taking care of going up in flames. And instead of being land managers and forest managers, they're firefighters. That's really what most of the budget for our federal agencies goes to anymore, is to fight fires. It doesn't have to be that way. This is something that should be bipartisan. It is going to be bipartisan today. It's something the Senate should take up in a bipartisan manner and get it to President Trump's desk as soon as possible.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The first is the Chinese incursion in the hemisphere involves, number one, investment of dollars.
During his nomination hearing, Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
As an example, they go into some country, they say, here's $5 million or $10 million to build a stadium, but in exchange, you have to let us build out your your 5G network using Huawei, safe cities, and the like. And by the way, here's a couple million dollars for you and your friends as a bribe. Okay, that's the first level of engagement. They go in and in some ways they create deals that you can not possibly pay back. So now you've got a debt that you can't pay back and they have you trapped. And now they've got your vote at the UN and your cooperation on X, Y, and Z. And that happened in Panama, by the way. In 2016, 2017, that was well understood that part of the investments they made in Panama were conditioned upon Panama's ability to convince the Dominican Republic and other countries to flip the recognition away from Taiwan. That happened. So that's number one. The second element of their involvement is they go into a country and a Chinese company will buy up the lithium mines or access to the rare earth minerals in these long-term contracts. And that exists in allied countries. The Argentines will tell you there are a number of business deals that the Chinese and Chinese companies have gotten a hold of in Argentina that even if they wanted to back away, they can't get out of the deals because of the way they were structured. So that's number two. And then number three is their presence. The Chinese are actively involved in a military installations in the Western Hemisphere on the island of Cuba, 90 miles from our shores. Only a few hundred miles from where Space Force operates and NASA and Cape Canaveral. Only a few miles from MacDill, where we have Central Command and Special Operations Command. Only a few miles from Southern Command. Only a few miles from Eglin Air Force Base and the test range we have out in the Gulf of Mexico. All of these things, this is real. And it's operating right off the coast of the United States. They have a presence in our region. So we have to acknowledge that this is happening. And then we have to be present and have counters to each of these, and or there has to be consequences for each of these. Fortunately, the United States has strong relationships in multiple key countries in the region, and I think we have the opportunity to build upon that and in ways that can attract the sort of investment that they would rather have than the Chinese investment. But right now it's not available. It's not happening. There is no American alternative to what the Chinese are offering. So hopefully we can provide the openings for that.
At the same time, Senate Ag Committee questioning Ag Secretary nominee Brooke Rollins.
In agriculture, as you know, we have a system of family-based farmers and ranchers across this country. 16 million people involved in agriculture in some way, shape, or form, versus look at all these other industries that are concentrated.
North Dakota Senator John Hovind.
We have this system of family-based farmers and ranchers, businesses, small businesses. And what they produce for every single American every single day is the highest quality, lowest cost food supply in the world. Americans have better choice, better quality, and spend less of their budget on food than almost any other developed country. That's what we have because we have good farm countercyclical safety net that works, keeping the farm in the farm bill. Will you commit to help us get that? We're past due. We need to get it done. Will you commit to help us get it done and get it done in the way I described?
Yes, sir. And again, maybe the pathological optimist in me, but I've talked to both the challenges in the last year or so of reauthorizing it. And I hope that I can be a force multiplier. And I hope what I bring to the table is the opportunity to work alongside both sides to get us where we need to be for our farmers and ranchers and some security, some, you know, understanding that the net is there and that the loans are there and that the insurance is there and that they can continue to be the best producers in the world for the world food supply. So I really look forward to that. Obviously providing you the technical assistance that you need to be able to do your job, but also if asked or if called to help in any other way I can to get this done.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A continued tightening of the U.S. cattle inventory to start the year? USDA livestock economist Mike McConnell says for the January cattle on feed report,
I think the major story that continues when it comes to cattle on feed is that placements still remain strong, relatively speaking, even though they're down slightly from a year ago. This is coming on the tails of a pretty strong run of placements in the third and fourth quarters.
When all told, 11.8 million head of cattle were on feedlots as of January 1st, a 1% decline from the previous year. December placements were down 3% from 2024. However,
there's still robust demand for cattle and for beef, as exhibited by the 1% increase in marketings during the month of September. And that's been reflective as well in the price of fed cattle, which has remained strong and, in fact, has crossed over the $200 per hundredweight mark in the month of January, looking at the five area fed steer price.
Another continuing trend, lower year-over-year heifer placements for the second consecutive quarter. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.